The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the morning session of our final day of Socialism 2010. I hope everyone's had a great weekend. I know I have. And now this morning, we're going to relax and have an excellent meeting on John Coltrane, featuring Martin Smith. I'm thrilled to introduce Martin. He's the National Secretary of the Socialist Workers' Party in the UK. He's the author of many, many books and pamphlets, but most especially John Coltrane, Jazz, Racism, and Resistance, which is on sale and is available at the end of this meeting, as well as many other titles. I'm just going to turn it over to him now, and we'll have a great presentation and then discussion.
Thanks very much, and good morning, everyone. That was the track we were playing just then. I don't know if you can hear it very well, but if you can't, I'd move forward a bit because we're going to play some more songs as we go through. It was a track called Welcome, and I thought that was a really good place to start any meeting. So Welcome, and that's Welcome from John Coltrane from somewhere else. What I'm going to try and do this meeting today is I'm not going to try and claim, as Frank Kofsky does in his book on Coltrane, that Coltrane was a revolutionary or this black nationalist striving to come out through his music. I don't really buy that argument, I have to be really honest. And I've interviewed his wife and three members of the band, and they don't really believe it either. So I think that'll do. But I do, and he certainly wasn't a political musician in the sense that Mingus or Max Roach or Abe Lincoln or anyone like that was. But I do believe, and I think this is almost uncontestable really, is that his music, whether consciously or subconsciously, is shaped by the political developments that take place in America. And more importantly, really, if you like, the people who listen to this music are certainly reading into it stuff that maybe John Coltrane wanted to come across, or even if they didn't, he articulated a sense of what's going on. And that's what I want to try and talk about. And I want to start, actually, with what I believe is the beginnings of the civil rights movement. And it's not really Rosa Parks for me. For me, it's a young man called Emmett Till. Really, Emmett Till is an incredible figure, really. He was a 15-year-old boy who lived in Chicago, who travelled down south to see his uncle and aunt in a place called Money, Mississippi. I don't know if anyone's ever been to Money, Mississippi. I have, and I drove through it, and I didn't even know I'd gone through it, and you had to go back again, because there's 3 hours, there's a church, and 3 hours of the church and a burnt-out shop, and we'll come back to the burnt-out shop in a minute. And Emmett Till went on his holiday, and Emmett Till came from the northern cities, where there was no, of course there was racism and segregation, but there was legal, you know, the laws against it. In the south, as you all know, you had the Jim Crow laws, you had legalised segregation from the cradle to the grave. For me, it's just like apartheid South Africa, that's the truth of it, and it was, those laws were reinforced by organisations like the White Citizens Council and the Ku Klux Klan. And Emmett Till went down there, and he was playing with his cousins, and there was outside this shop that you can see in Money, and this Emmett was boasting to his friends that he had a white girlfriend. And they said it was impossible. No black boy could have a white girlfriend in the South, and didn't believe him. So they dared him. And this white woman goes into the shop, and he said, bye, baby. As she left the shop, he goes to her, bye, baby, bye. Really simple, three words, bye, baby, bye. That night, her husband and two accomplices came round his uncle's house, dragged him out, and a few days later they found him in the Tallahatchie River, tied to a cotton gin with barbed wire, his face smashed to smithereens, his eye popped out. And normally I show this, I show slides as I talk, and his mother published a photograph of his bashed up face, and it went in every black paper, not only in America, but I've got a copy in the Sunday Times in England with it on, and it shocked not just black Americans, I think it shocked the world. And his mother said that she came and spoke in London at the Royal Albert Hall, and when she got up to speak, I've got a tape of this, and apparently she said this everywhere she went. She said, Emmett, my son, is a little nobody, and I'm a little nobody, but my little nobody is going to change the world. which is an incredible, moving thing. And I believe really that is what sparked. I think for a layer of people, that was the point in which enough is enough. I mean, Emmett was nowhere near the first young black boy to be killed, but I think it was this cannot carry on any longer, and it sparks the civil rights movement. And why I start there is because the very first album John Coltrane ever recorded as a solo artist on the Prestige record label was an album called Coltrane. And on that, the very first track is a track called Dakai. And for those who don't know, Dakai is Arabic, and it means peace. And it was written by a man called Cal Macy. Archie Shepp done a fantastic version of it several years later. And Coltrane, and Dakai means, for those who don't know, it means peace, but it's dedicated to Emmett Till. So the very first song Coltrane produces on thing, so I think we should just listen to the opening minute of Dakai and peace, and to Emmett. My DJ today, DJ Nicole, so we'll have to give her a cheer in a minute. I'm not going to go into what happened 4 months later, in 1st of December 1955. It's the most famous part of the civil rights movement, where Rosa Parks says, my feet are tired and my soul is weary and I'm not getting off your bus. And it does spark the civil rights movement, and it brings into the fore Martin Luther King. But why it's important in terms of this story is, if you go to John Coltrane's house in Philadelphia, I went there and I knocked on the door, and this woman opened the door and she said, "Hi, my name's Mary, I'm John Coltrane's cousin." And if you know Giant Steps, there's a song called Cousin Mary, and that's her. And I told her, "There's a song written about you." She says, "I know, not many people know that." And I thought it was a wonderful way of meeting somebody like that. I just thought it was an amazing little thing. Anyway, if you go to the house, you'll see on Coltrane's, in his book study, a whole series of reel-to-reel tapes. And they start in 1956, actually. And they go right way through to 1965. And they are a series of King's and Ray Abernathy's speeches. And Coltrane collects them, which I never knew. I didn't put it in my books, I didn't know that at the time, but that's what he does. He collects these of speeches and he listens to them. This is going to come back in the story later on. And so, really what happens, almost at the same time as Rosa Parks goes on the bus and refuses to move, Coltrane signs to the Miles Davis Band. And this is completely unrelated and unconnected to anything to do with the civil rights movement. I'm just putting it into some kind of context here. And he joins really what is, at that point, the biggest band in the world, our jazz band in the world, I'd argue. I mean, you can argue, but I think that's the truth. And they've released a series of albums under kind of working, steaming, cooking, relaxing, all with a G taken off, all meant to be hip terms. And they are a fantastic series of albums, actually. Really adventurous, really beautifully portrayed. And if you compare the rest of the band to Coltrane, Coltrane's a newcomer in the band. And the key point of it, they weren't producing this wonderful music in a vacuum. They are part of what's called the hard bop jazz scene. Now, I don't know if you use the same terms as we do in England, so if I don't, I apologise, but hard bop is what we call it in England. And for those who don't know, I'm going to try and explain a little bit about it. And I'm not going to use lots of jazz terms, because I know some people don't find it confusing. But the kind of artists we're talking about, really, is Art Blakey, Jimmy Smith, Donald Byrd, Hank Mobley, you name it, chuck them all in. This is the kind of stuff from Blue Note, Prestige, and other labels. And it's a wonderful music. And I think there's four key elements to it. I know there's a lot that's more complicated than this, but for the purposes of this meeting, it's just worth it. There are four key elements. First is it goes back to an earlier form of jazz, bebop, the music of Charlie Parker, you know, Dizzy Gillespie, and the rest of them, which is really, I mean, just put it, small groups playing very, very technical, fast music, very complex. And really, if you want my opinion, it's the big prototype of early black pride. Charlie Parker says, I'm not an entertainer, I'm an artist. You don't treat me as an entertainer, you treat me as an artist. And it's the beginnings of saying, actually, we're not just here, we are creating real art that has to be appreciated in those terms, and we're not just going to sit in clubs and you just drink your beer and chat over us and, you know, and do this. And I think it's a very, very important step. Secondly, they bring back into jazz, in my opinion, a break from the cool period, which I really don't like, I have to be honest. They bring back into jazz the art of the improvisation, which is very, very important, because I think this makes jazz one of the most democratic musics. Why? Because what improvisation does inside jazz is it allows the band to play collectively together, so they become collective, and then within each song or within each set, each individual member of the band is allowed to play their own element, their own improvisation, which allows the individual creativity to come out of it, then back to the collective again. So it's a highly democratic form of music, which actually enables, Gillespie described it as a university for musicians. This idea that you play on a bandstand with some of the greatest people around you, and you learn from each other, you learn riffs and refrains and new techniques. The third thing, and I think this is vital in terms of the hard bop movement, is it brings back the blues. And the blues are the central element, I believe, to black music in America. I'm not just about the blues from the field workers or industrial blues, but you can go right the way through American black popular music, and the blues is central to it, and that includes soul, funk, and actually very much a lot of hip-hop. The fourth element is gospel. If you go really before 1955-54 in America, gospel does not really feature very greatly in jazz music. In fact, most people would regard it as a secular music. And why is it in 55, 56 and 57, gospel elements begin to come in to the music? Art Blakey was asked that question by Jazz Times. And he said, why? Because Martin Luther King used the pulpit to convey a spirit, a message, and actually we want to bring that into our music. And a profound statement from Blakey, one of many actually. The man was the vanguard of the youth, was also the vanguard of politically trying to come to understand what his music was about, in my opinion. The last element of it is what Mingus describes as the back to our roots movement. And I want to make two points about this. First is that you begin to see really... if you go before 1955, I can name three or four key black songs, black musicians in jazz, who openly sing music in defiance of racism, that openly come out. I mean, there may be more, but I mean, the obvious ones are Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit, Black and Blue by Louis Armstrong, Black, Brown and Bass Suite by Duke Ellington. And then you're pushing Art Blakey, Trumpeter. Anyway, there's one more and I can't think of it off the top of my head right now. But nonetheless, you've very, very few. Suddenly, from 55, if you're a record collector like me, suddenly you start to see these covers. And there's a slight difference between them. They start having titles like Now's the Time, The Prophet, The Freedom Suite. The Freedom Suite's by Sonny Rollins, Now's the Time by Roach, and all that. And really... they're obvious what they're, but the Prophet's obvious what the Prophet is. The Prophet's Muhammad, the Nation of Islam, the Elijah Muhammad. Now's the time, come on, now's the time for what? Change, civil rights, revolution, can mean all kinds of things. And the Freedom Suite again is obvious. But it's a codified message, and Art Blakey once again comes to an interesting conclusion. They ask Art Blakey, why are you producing a codified message? And this is his reply. Well, those that know, and those that don't need to know, don't need to know. This is brilliant. And I want to explain why you would say that. Because it's not true. Today, if you make an anti-racist record, to be honest with you, sometimes it can boost your career. Clearly, those artists who tried to make a stand at that point, many of them, were faced some of them, they're deaf. I mean, the bassist that was behind his band was murdered in the South on tour because he had a suit on and looked better than the white crackers that walked past him in the street. Prince Nasruddin, Coltrane's best friend, was battered to death in the streets of Philadelphia by a policeman because he wouldn't refuse to walk in the gutter as he went by. Duke Ellington, the biggest band leader in the world, had to tour his own train around the South because he could not find a hotel in which to put his band in. I mean, it's incredible levels of racism. A.B. Lincoln, in the 60s, after she recorded a wonderful album with Max Roach on it, found it almost impossible to record again for several years. So these artists that spoke out actually were, you know, putting their careers and in some cases their life into jeopardy. And therefore there was a codified message, but it's also important, this is the beginnings where a series of artists begin openly to begin to challenge it. The most obvious ones are A.B. Lincoln and Max Roach, Sonny Rollins and Charlie Mingus. They're the beginnings of people who no longer have a codified message, but begin to express it in a much more open way. I mean, Fables and all the rest of it from Mingus is just something else. And Mingus hangs around the Communist Party, so did Max Roach. Max Roach, both as a black... I was very fortunate to meet Black Roach before he died. And I went to the apartment, and he's both a black nationalist and a communist at the same time. And he has both texts all over his library and talks in those terms. And I think that's important. And it's not true that Coltrane at this point is part of that pushing the political argument. I don't believe that's true, and I can't think of things that does that. I think it's 56, late 56, Coltrane is kicked out of the Davis band. He's a drug addict. He's completely losing it. I mean, he's literally sitting on the bandstand picking his nose and throwing up. And he's losing control. And there's a very famous, which I didn't think was true, I thought it was one of these kind of jazz myths, but I've had it confirmed since, that at one club, Miles Davis gets up and smashes Coltrane in the face and says, "You're a drunken bum," and keeps hitting him. And a man with a little pork pie hat on and glasses stands up, a man called Thelonious Monk, and says, "For God's sake, man, leave him alone. Can't you see? He's very, very sick indeed." And Coltrane is kicked out of the band. And to be honest with you, that's probably, as he says, it's probably the greatest thing that ever happened to him. Because I think two things happen. One is the man undertakes what I think you'd have to say is a spiritual reawakening of his life, both in terms of his health. He comes off drugs, except he always takes LSD. He's a good man in that way. He takes LSD for the rest of his life. He's a big LSD fan. And we all love a bit of LSD. Well, I certainly did anyway, and I still do, actually, when I get the chance. Big LSD freak, but came off the most important thing, which is heroin, really, which is methadone. Secondly, he becomes very, very health conscious. He eats much better. I mean, a bit like me. He eats sweets all the time. His teeth were going, and he had problems with his blowing technique and stuff. And the third thing is he kind of becomes, I think, a spiritual reawakening, where he doesn't take one religion, but if you look at it, he tries to incorporate all religions, and in some ways, I think it kind of symbolises his music, because what he talks about is there is something that connects all music together, whether it's bagpipe music from Scotland, Indian maggas, the jazz of Afro-Caribbean Americans, and they're kind of back to the motherland of Africa. He talks about this being there's a constant thing that connects them all together, just like there is humanity. So he, although he's incredibly spiritual, he sees it very much in terms of his own worldview of music and the rest. And the other important thing for us, I think, in this story, is while he is in recovery, if you spoke, he begins to record with Monk and play quite regularly with Monk. And what Coltrane talks about is, I think this begins to completely redevelop his style again for the first major time, and there's going to be several more big changes. He watches what Monk does on piano. I don't know if anyone's ever seen film of Monk, or if you've been fortunate enough ever to see him live, but he certainly plays the piano like a percussive instrument. He doesn't play it like a classical musician. He uses, I mean, sometimes you see him use literally the palms of his hands to strike many chords at the same time and stack notes up one another. And what Coltrane does is Coltrane watches him perform and begins to say if he can adapt this system, and he spends day after day, year after year, practicing this to create a system of playing chords on top of one another. Ira Gitlard, a great jazz critic, described it as a sheets of sound. And this begins to pull into his next phase of his music. And really, I mean, the way it's described, I mean, read Miles Davis's biography. Miles Davis always puts himself at the centre of everything, even if he's nothing to do with it. He's still there. The Black Panther's only come about because Miles Davis had to pop into it. The man lives in a fantasy world. He said he was the greatest boxer that never boxed. I mean, thing. And he locates his own thing. He said, I trained up Coltrane to get rid of him. And when he goes, but then I saw the cat again, and I thought, I have to get that man back in my band, because I taught him such great things, and now he's pulled himself together. And he goes back in there. Coltrane also signs up to Atlantic Records, and records both in terms of Miles Davis's band, and his own band. And really, I think if you're going to talk about this period, it is the second first transformation of Coltrane thing. First, he records with Miles Davis, probably the greatest that jazz album's ever made, Kind of Blue. And all I'd say to you, if you haven't got this record, you need it in your life, like you need it more than anything, more than food, in my opinion, and that's saying something. Kind of Blue is the blues to the highest form, I'd argue. It's almost like a classical version of the blues. It's just like, and they call it modal jazz, I'm sure it's the same term. This kind of, just sweeping musical statement of the musicianship of really the highest quality. I mean, just without doubt. The second is his own solo album, Giant Steps. If you're going to get another jazz album, this is one to get as well. Every track on Giant Steps, bar one, in my opinion, is a jazz standard, classic jazz record that many people go back to. And it's really where you see for the first time Coltrane recording openly in the Sheets of Sound thing. He also used this period, 59, 60, to pull around him the nucleus of what is going to be called the John Coltrane, the classic quartet, which is Elvin Jones on the drums, the wonderful Jimmy Garrison on bass, and the marvellous McCoy Tyner on piano. I want to be very clear about it yet. Although it is the nucleus of the band, Coltrane never just has one settled band. He always brings in new musicians. Eric Dolphy plays a very, very important role in the band, certainly for the next couple of years. And Coltrane often experiments with two drummers, often two basses. Sometimes he had sitar players playing, even had the bagpipes on stage. Well, no, I have a bootleg of that. What is fascinating by it is when I first met Elvin Jones and interviewed him for this book I'm just about to put out, Elvin Jones said, you know, I hated the man. He said, I turned up to a recording studio and there were two sets of drums. And he goes, I stormed out, I saw Coltrane in the crowd. I said, I won't say what he called him. He said, how can you do that to me? You just been another drum room without even telling me about it. How would you like it if I brought a saxophone player and it come along and play side you? He goes, I have. I've just done it. And Elvin Jones said, for the first time, made him realise it was not about egos. For him, it was very much about trying to find new ways of experimentation. It was not about threatening people, not about trying to downplay people, but all the time about experimentation. And although Elvin and him had many arguments around this sort of thing, Elvin admits, and very open about it before he died, that this was an important way forward. Really, after Kind of Blue, I think they go on a European tour of the band. Davis and Coltrane quits halfway through and finishes off the tour and goes solo and pulls his band together. And then leaves Atlantic and signs to Impulse. And why Impulse is very important, because not only does Coltrane become the second highest paid jazz musician in the world, he is given absolute artistic freedom. He is allowed any amount of compared to before, you know, Prestige, they call it the junkies label. They would literally sometimes pay you either $25 for a session and a bag of cocaine or a bag of heroin to keep you quiet. I mean, this is brutal capitalist economics, if you want to put it any other way. And they do this. And with that Impulse, not only is it music creative that he's got freedom on, even the record label, even the record covers, the artistic notes, and he consciously picks key people to write his notes. And that's not, you know, Kofsky, Leroy Jones, all write his notes. And you don't pick those kind of people for no reason at all. I mean, they're always on the, you know, the hard left or black nationalist culture in America. And really, what I would argue is the development of this Impulse, the great albums that come up from Africa Brass, the one with Duke Ellington, the ballads, Coltrane, Crescent, and finally Love Supreme, is that this is Coltrane's third revolutionary period where he creates a new and almost unique sound. I mean, I defy anyone to put any of those records on within minutes, seconds. You know it's Coltrane, you know the sound, and you know where we're going. It's also interesting at this time that Costis argues that he goes and sees Malcolm once. Alice Coltrane says that he went and saw Malcolm several times, that he begins to do something like, in 63, 38 benefits to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in Core. That's a lot of... I can't think of many other artists that do that number of benefits. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. But any musician that does benefits for, you know, Core or any of these organisations is serious. And he also puts Plough's money into various kind of, I don't know, called Afrocentric clubs, particularly one in New York, but and others in Los Angeles and San Francisco. But before we move on the story, we have to go to a very important point in Coltrane's life, and something he identifies as something that alters his mind, which is Birmingham. And it's the very, very important phase for Martin Luther King. Because really, after Montgomery, what happens is there's a real debate inside the Southern Christian Leadership Conference that they're losing. The radicals are beginning to move away from King. There's no great victories like Montgomery. Much of the Freedom Riders is out of the way from King's own organisation. The radicals are nibbling at his heels, and he's losing some authority in the movement. And they decide to go for Operation Birmingham, where they go. Two things about Birmingham. Birmingham was the heart of the White Citizens Council, from what I can see. Secondly, it was run by a man called Eugene Bull Connor. Eugene Bull Connor was the thug of all thugs. When they announced they were going to march in Birmingham, Eugene Bull Connor called a press conference in his office, and behind the press conference, he had a billy club smeared in blood. And one of the journalists said to him, "What's that billy club?" And he said, "Oh, in 1936, 37, I can't remember which year it was, the steelworkers tried to organise, the communist steelworkers tried to organise in this city. And I hit the organiser over the head with that billy club." And what he didn't say was he paralysed the man and brain damaged him for the rest of his life. And he said, "That's up there." And he said, one other thing, he said, "And they're going to need some more blood on that billy club, the blood of Martin Luther King." So we know this was going to be a major conflict. And what King's strategy was not to desegregate one bus company or one beach or one hotel or one facility that was segregated, but to take on the whole downtown business sector, the whole thing in one go. And I want to play a speech now in a second, which is when King goes to Birmingham, there is massive rejection of him by much of the Birmingham church groups. Leaders don't like it. There's a famous letter called Letter to Birmingham, which is an attack on King. And if you go to Birmingham, it's worth looking at the church there. I mean, when I come in England, the church in England are just a joke, man. There's about three people on a Sunday worshipping now. I mean, literally, honestly, I'm not joking. The black churches are bigger, but nonetheless, the church, there's not much church stuff. You go and you read the records of these meetings. They are huge. I'm going to play a speech that was at 3 o'clock in the morning just before they go. Now, 3 o'clock in the morning is a long time to sit and wait from all day to hear someone speak. And they're waiting, these two of the churches. And this is King speaking at the 16th Baptist Church, which is the heart of the black resistance in Birmingham, I argue. So this is Martin Luther King. Maybe not.
Dr. Martin Luther King! Thank you very kindly, my very dear friend. These churches are really loaded tonight. Never in the history of this nation have so many people been arrested for the cause of freedom and human dignity. You know there are approximately 2,500 people in jail right now. Now let me say this, the thing that we are challenged to do is to keep this movement moving. There is power in unity and there's power in numbers. As long as we keep moving like we are moving, the power structure of Birmingham will have to give in. And we are probably nearer to a solution of this problem than we are able to realize. And don't worry about your children. They are going to be all right. Don't hold them back if they want to go to jail. But they are doing a job for not only themselves, but for all of America and for all mankind. Somewhere we read, a little child shall lead them. Remember, there was another little child, just 12 years old, and he got involved in a discussion back in Jerusalem. As his parents moved down the dusty road, leading them back to their little village of Nazareth. And when they got back and bothered him and touched him and wanted him to move on at that moment, he said, I must be about my father's business. These young people are about their father's business. And they are carving a tunnel of hope through the great mountain of despair. And they will bring to this nation a newness and a genuine quality and an idealism that it so desperately needs. Now we are going to see that they are treated right. Don't worry about that. The Justice Department is already in here. And they don't have some small fish from the Justice Department. They have some of the big fish in here. We are reminding them at all times that these persons are political prisoners. And there's a distinction between a political prisoner and somebody who's there for getting drunk, or somebody who's there for engaging in a robbery. And we're going to see that they are treated right. And go on and not only fill up the jails around here, but just fill up the jails all over the state of Alabama if necessary. Keep this movement going. Keep this movement rolling. In spite of the difficulties, and we're going to have a few more difficulties, keep climbing. Keep moving. If you can't fly, run. If you can't run, walk. If you can't walk, crawl. But by all means, keep moving.
What brilliant speech. I mean, it encapsulates everything about the people's fears and trying to overcome them. And it's brilliant. This is what happens next door. Now, the next morning. Well, that morning. When the doors of the 16th Street Baptist Church opened, a line of 50 teenagers emerged two abreast, singing. The waiting police detail hauled them into the jail wagons. As usual. And only the youth had demonstrated the things today, until a second line emerged, then a third, and many more. Children as young as four held their ground, and then were arrested. Amid mounting confusion, police commanders called in school buses for jail transport and sent reinforcements in to intercept stray lines that slipped past them towards the downtown business district. Not a few of the onlookers in Kelly Ingram Park were dismayed to see their own disobedient offspring in the line, and the conflicting emotions of centuries played on their faces until some finally gave way. One elderly woman ran along the rest line shouting, sing children, for God's sake sing. That day another 2,000 were arrested, including King. They filled every single jailhouse in Birmingham. They filled every jailhouse in the state of Alabama. Ray Abernathy took over and said, we march again. And they marched, another 300 arrested. Ray Abernathy goes back to church, we go again the next day, and they march again. They did this for 9 days. They filled every single jail in the state. Eugene Bull Connor asked for two things. He wants other states to open up their jails, and he also asked the government, can he use live ammunition on these people? And just so you know, the youngest arrested, according to Taylor Branch, was 4, and the oldest was jailed was 89. And he wanted to use live ammunition on 4-year-olds and 89-year-olds. And that man should always be remembered for what he is, one of the biggest scumbags the world has ever seen. And on the ninth day of that protest, as you know, King wins. It's the biggest victory, I'd argue, for the civil rights movement in America. It is bashes the heart out of them of that. In one of that speeches, I had to cut it, but in that speech, King says one other thing. He says, this goes on for about 5 minutes, but one point he says, I want to be really honest with you tonight. Some of you on this demonstration are not going to come back alive, but you're doing it for a greater cause than yourself. Now, I don't know how you feel about this, but if I was to stand up to you and say, right, tomorrow morning we're going to go out marching around Chicago here. By the way, some of you probably get shot. Will you go? It's an incredible thing for them to go out and next morning and do that. I mean, although King was actually wrong about the actual demonstrations, no one was killed. I mean, partly because of the sheer size of the organisation and the media, I think they didn't. But King was right, though, actually indirectly, because after the victory of Birmingham, the White Citizens Council then go on the rampage and start planting bombs around the churches and start blowing them up and setting fire to key people's houses. And one went off in the 16th Street Baptist Church in the basement of it. 4 young black girls were killed.
Again, you know, not the first victims, but I can't remember who said it now, but someone said a certain piece of her soul was ripped out of us that day, and really nothing could ever be the same again. And Coltrane spoke at Martin Luther King spoke at three of those girls' funerals, and Coltrane gets hold of a copy of the speech of Martin Luther King's funeral oration, and he writes the following song called Alabama. You can get a version of it on the live at Birdland. I'm going to play it for a few minutes, and then I'm going to talk about what the band said to me, what was behind it. So this is called Alabama. In fact, to save time, I'm going to talk over it, I think, because I ain't got much time left. There are three elements to this piece of music that you need to kind of know, in my opinion. One is Elvin Jones. And what Elvin Jones said when he was interviewed, he said that the band discussed the piece of music, read the speech, and they were all told to find a way of incorporating it into the music. So Elvin Jones' his contribution is there is a drum roll coming up very, very soon, and a drum roll at the very end of the piece of music. And he says the first drum roll was to symbolise his anger at the murder of those four young black girls. The last drum roll is to symbolise his anger and determination, as he put it, we've got to keep on keeping on. Then we have McCoy Tyner's contribution. What McCoy says is he goes back and looks at old Southern Blues records and listens to some, and tries to find a rhythm that begins to try and create the sound of the Deep South. And he said something else. He said Coltrane, for those who don't know, Coltrane was born in the South, in Carolinas. And he moved to Philadelphia as a young man to find work during the war. And Coltrane writes in his one of his books, he says, I hate the stench of the South, and I'm never going to go there again. And throughout his whole life, Coltrane never crosses the Mason-Dixon line, never goes down there, never plays down there, always refused, even very, very lucrative concerts, never goes. So McCoy is trying to create the sound of the South, and anyone who's seen any film, this track is often used in films, Spike Lee used it and stuff. There's no doubt that you feel the South and the music is beautiful. The last piece is Coltrane saxophone playing, and we do this when we have decks, we do it together. If you play Martin Luther King's speech and you play Coltrane saxophone, the piece of music lasts exactly the same length as Martin Luther King's speech, and when you play it side by side, the cadence of it mirrors exactly. So when King rises up, the saxophone, but when it goes down, so in other words, Coltrane is copying King's oration. I think that says two things, actually. It says, one, it explains a lot about why King is such a brilliant speaker, because he seems that he speaks like an angel, if there's such a thing in the world. But, you know, I wouldn't be a bit liberal with Mark, so sometimes we can use these things about being too worried about the term. If an angel existed, it's probably what it would sing like. And we know that, don't we? So we could just say that. The second thing about it is, I think it also explains why Coltrane is such a genius. Because to transfer words, and I think he does it in Love Supreme, just that refrain actually does it, but through words to do this is something which makes him a genius in the real, in the total sense of the world, and to be honest with you, in any form of music, one of the greatest musicians. This is the last bit, and this is Elvin's determination that the civil rights movement goes on. Could I have 5 more minutes, is that okay? It's going to start rolling around the kit in a second.
That's Alabama.
One of the greatest pieces of music to come out of the civil rights movement, I'd argue, on par with, you know, Otis Redding and Sam Cooke's version of Change Is Going to Come, on a par with Curtis Mayfield. Really a wonderful piece of music. Really, the quartet, the high point of the quartet is the release of A Love Supreme, which sells 500,000 copies in the first year of release. I know compared to Michael Jackson and Nas and Jay-Z and all this kind of stuff, it's very low beer. In jazz terms, it's monumental. And it's massive, and if there's a third album you can go out and buy it today, that's got to be it. It is the high point of the quartet, and it is a gospel-infused piece of jazz. It is spirituality on vinyl or CD or on MP3 now, for you younger ones who don't know what bloody vinyl is. It makes me so sad to think you're never going to enjoy it, but smelling vinyl as it comes out, it's as good as LSD in my humble opinion. Now, this is Coltrane reaches the high point musically, of his, you know, in terms of popularity. He then does something quite incredible. His next album is an album called Ascension, which assembles 16-piece, I can't remember now, 16-piece band, and it goes into this recording studio with just the most basic sketch of patterns, and everybody plays free on it. Now, why it's a path-breaking album is, before this, Coltrane was not the first person, you may not call it free, some people call it fire music in England, and some people call it avant-garde. I mean, it's the same bloody music, just different titles for it. Ornette's famous album, Free Jazz, the one with the fantastic Pollock painting on the front, which I think symbolises the music, actually, in my opinion. Sort of the textures, the layers of sound and all that. What Coleman does is the drums and the bass play to musical sheets, and the band improvises over the top. What Coltrane does, he goes one step further, and everybody plays free. Now, let me just be clear about this. Coltrane, in my opinion, is the only hard bopper to go over to free jazz. I can't name anyone, main ones, I'm not saying there wasn't individual smaller, but main bands, no one really moves into this direction. Coltrane does. And whether you like free jazz, I know this is really controversial, whether you like free jazz, the idea as an artist that you have one of the biggest selling albums of all time, and then you just turn into some of the most complex music ever recorded, that sold just 5,000 copies, was commercial suicide in that sense. Whether you like it or not, your starting point has to be that brave, because that is an artist not looking for a financial reward, but is looking to express himself and move his art forward. And that has got to be something we celebrate. The second reason why it's important is free jazz. Although sometimes you have to concentrate very hard when you listen to it, you have to follow it, and in fact it's a required taste and it takes time. But it seems to me, like all things that are avant-garde, sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. I think Coltrane's music does work. And what it does is it pushes the boundaries of art and extends them and pushes them forward further. And there is no greater achievement of any artist than to do that. That should be the desire of every artist, to begin to find new ways of expression. You see, if you don't do that, you end up with X Factor, you end up with pop idols and all the rest of it. We need artists that are going to continually find new avenues of it. The last point about this is, I don't think you can divorce it from what is going on around in America at this time. You have the explosion from civil rights to black power. You have the Vietnam War coming haunting back. And it's worth knowing that when Coltrane toured Japan, he went to Hiroshima, the site of the nuclear bomb drop, and prayed for world peace. He spoke out against the Vietnam War. I think Kofsky pushes him to say it, but he does come out and say it. And he certainly begins to incorporate this. And this is not just my opinion. Let me get the right page. 96, in this wonderful book. I mean, this is such a great book, this one. This is what Rashid Ali, who became Coltrane's drummer. I mean, it's worth knowing that the band kind of almost imploded because McCoy and Elvin just can't stand it and leave. I mean, both in their own quotes say, "I just couldn't hear myself play inside the band." And Coltrane brings in a new generation of young musicians, including his wife Alice, to play. This is Rashid Ali. They were trying times in the 1960s. We had the civil rights thing going on. We had King, we had Malcolm, we had the Panthers. There was so much diversity happening. People were screaming for their rights and wanting to be equal, be free. And naturally, the music reflects that period. And the whole time, it definitely influenced the way we played. And I think that's where that's where our musical ideas really came from. The last few albums that Coltrane produces continues in that desire
to drive music forward become more and more experimental. Meditations, Interstellar Space is literally just him and Rashid giving it something like you've never ever heard. Then you have the kind of cosmic music just as he dies and all this. It's a fantastic exploration. One of his albums is dedicated to King. It's almost like he knows he's going to die. And many people believe this, and I don't know if it's true or not, but obviously he had cancer, and he dies a couple of years after thing. And you think, really, we're talking about a 10-year period from 56 to his death, or just slightly over 10 years, where he produces some of the greatest music and transforms and revolutionises his own music at least 3 or 4 times, and that's an incredible thing for an artist. But this is my last point, Coltrane's legacy. Because the fact is that Coltrane is now more popular than ever before. And I want to try and explain why I think that's the case. We had Rage Against the Machine come and play in England the other week, and they came on to Meditations by Coltrane. So if you like your rock, your heroes of rock love Coltrane. The Grateful Dead did. If you like hip-hop, if you like your conscious hip-hop, you know, if you like Talib Kweli, Mos Def, Common, all of them have sampled Coltrane. All of them name-check Coltrane, and all of them see him as a way forward. In England, we have a music form called Drum and Bass, which is a variant of hip-hop, which again samples Elvin Jones all the time and keeps coming back to it and coming back to it and coming back to it. Why? Because I think there's 2 reasons. Coltrane is a musical giant, and in the case of all musical giants, to kind of look further afield, you have to stand on their shoulders. And I think every new generation of people trying to find new ways of expressing themselves stand on Coltrane's shoulders. The last reason I think is also true, that despite all the changes that have taken place in the 1960s, Coltrane, whether consciously or unconsciously, expresses a music which expresses hatred of racism. And you can't tell me after New Orleans that racism still has gone away. You can't tell me when you look around in England, the rise of the EDL, that somehow racism has gone away, and if it connects to those people who want to see it challenged, and war. Coltrane was for peace all his life. It seems to me that if you want to find ways of expressing your hope in humanity and the great in humanity, well then there's no better person than Coltrane. And we stand and we're standing on the shoulder of, literally on the shoulder of a giant. And that's why I think it's important that we continue to celebrate Coltrane's music, because it's so enriching and so much more important for us. And it is as important as our lives.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.